You ready? 1, 2, 3. Right, we are in Rory's man cave, would you call it?
Well, it started off as a man cave when we first moved in it, but now it's kind of become just my office, which is a bit more boring, isn't it? And also, it makes me sound a bit poncy, like I'm rich enough to have an office. It's pretty much my spare room.
Yeah, I mean, you are a little bit poncy sometimes. You've got this Viking memorabilia in the back of this wall.
Thierry on the wall.
Real Betis.
I've got a Real Betis logo up there. Yeah,
yeah, you've got yourself in your 11 aside.
I've got myself a picture of, yeah.
Middlesex legends.
Middlesex legends football team.
Yeah.
There's a few faces on there that no one will recognise.
They're probably because they're in prison. That's all right. Fucking hot today, isn't it?
Ridiculous. That's partly the reason we're in it, to be fair, because it is the coolest. Well, my living room is probably the coolest, but it's got an AC unit in there.
That does help, yeah.
That's really loud.
Yeah.
So we was a bit worried about the audio.
Got our summer gear on.
This is my try not to melt gear, to be honest, man.
What?
This is more my try not to melt gear.
Do you ever wear this?
I think when you're built like me, wearing a vest is a
What are you built like? A scarecrow?
A beanpole. I think when you're tall and skinny, and you wear a vest or a tank top or a wife beater or whatever your preferred term is for it, I think you run the risk of looking a bit like something out of The Hills Have Eyes. Or like...
I've not seen it. What's that, redneck?
It's like a bit redneck, murdery sort of thing.
Yeah, I don't know. So, I mean, wearing vests can be a bit of a weird one. Sometimes I wear some vests and I'm like, that's not a good look. And sometimes I wear something like this and I'm like, straight fire.
I think if you're quite big, it does. Like,
What the fuck are you talking about?
If you're quite a big geezer, wearing a vest can look alright. But I just think if you're tall and skinny, not for me. I don't think I could pull it off.
No?
Although, yeah, that's one of your best fits I've seen today. It was striking. Was you wearing a hat when you came in?
No, it's too hot for that shit.
Put a hat on with that. That's actually a look. That's like an Ocean Beach Ibiza look. Or like pool party in Marbella look.
This could either be my beach wear or my pyjamas. I tend to wear this at home a lot of the time. But
a lot of your outfits can be said the same though.
To be fair, that is true. I mean, I'm a man of comfort. Do you know what I mean? I ain't trying to wear clothes that sort of... When you're this big, when you're a beanpole, you can pretty much wear whatever you like.
Other than a wife beater.
But in terms of just pure comfort level, when you're built like a tree stump, you know, 5'8", but just as wide. You know, outfits tend to just be around comfort, and you know, I just wear what's comfortable for me. But
that's fair enough.
Yeah, yeah.
We're going to talk about comedy today.
Yeah, why not?
We have to caveat this by saying we did what I thought was one of our best ever podcast episodes.
Apologies.
The day Arsenal played Fulham, so two weeks ago today.
2 weeks ago, because we're trying to do this every 2 weeks, I guess. I do want to apologise to the fan. I'm joking, whoever that is. This is a work in progress, but we will gradually get better. Trying to work on the audio. I've been spending fucking far too long just before this trying to sort out, doing my head in, so I've gone back to the original way of doing it, so apologies for that.
Stick with us. But yeah, so we sat in your flat the morning of the Arsenal-Fulham game.
Yeah.
And we was both a bit eager to get out and have a few beers and enjoy the festivities. And one thing led to another. We did the best podcast we've ever done.
Yeah, what we've done, we've done like five now, maybe or four. One we've released.
And then we forgot to record it.
It wasn't that. I'm trying this software thing that it basically allows us to have two mics instead of one. And because I'm basically, you know, not that anyone cares, I'm basically using two versions now to get this sorted. So the quality might not be where we want it to be. Your mic seems to be good. Maybe I just need to improve my mic quality. But right now, this is what we got. Hopefully, at some point, I'll be able to do it a bit more streamlined. But fuck me, it's hard.
Yeah. I think maybe I bought this probably about 2 years ago. I'll look on my Amazon. And maybe I can plug it and we'll get a sponsor.
Could do.
But yeah,
Toner.
I think I just bought it on Amazon. But I'll check my purchase history. I don't know how far back it goes. Anyway, I digress. So, you've got your own night. Tell us about it.
Yes. So, a lot of the podcast before, and we'll talk about it now, is I've started my new night. It's called the OM Comedy Club. OM stands for open mic, if no one gets that. Everyone keeps saying OM. I'm still sick with the name. I thought it was great beforehand. I'm having some reservations now. But we've had two nights now, and they've just been absolutely... It's just been above... No, I don't know if it's above what I expected. I worked towards it being a good night. I spent a lot of effort in trying to put it together, try and be mindful around the lineups and everything that goes into it, really. And fortunately, I have a lot of good friends like yourself to come out and support. And the first two have just been excellent. The first one went down amazing. Opening night, I was a bit nervous at first. But then once it started going, I was going. I think really as the night was going on, I grew into myself as the MC. Everyone seemed to have a great night. And then after that, like, people were reaching out. The social media, the Instagram page was just getting more and more, followers. And then after the second one, it was even more. And I've had so many more people coming out and asking to get on. So, you know, it's good that a lot of people are interested. There was a part of me originally when I was putting it together, like, I remember one of our mates, our common friends, I'll say it now, I know we're not doing names all the time, but Danny was like, you know, what am I going to do to make people know about it if I don't have social media and I don't do things like that? Part of me kind of wanted to keep it a little bit underground and kind of keep it like word of mouth, because I know enough people, I see them out on the circuit, and one of the reasons was, is like, if it gets too much attention too quick, it's like, I don't know if I'm going to be able to fill spaces. You know, there's so many people that I want to get on. It's supposed to be for new acts, new material, progression. But you can only have limited spots. And the reason I'm doing it every 2 weeks is just because I couldn't manage it doing it week in, week out. I don't know how some people do it. Maybe once it becomes a bit more routine and it works itself out. Right now, there's still a lot of stress involved with it. But, yes, I mean, it's been amazing. What do you think?
So, yeah, I've been to both so far. The first one, it was one of them where it's because it's a Sunday night, so you know. So, and I'm not one of them people that's like out on days other than Friday and Saturday. So no. When it came down to the Sunday, I was like, oh, I've got to go to this thing tonight. I'm a bit. I wouldn't say I was dreading it, but I was like,
I know what you mean.
I hope I'm not dragging myself out on a Sunday night for something. But obviously, I'm gonna go because I'm gonna support my mate, and I had such a good time. Like, it was such a great time. Like, the acts were all brilliant. Both weeks, actually, the acts have been really good, really high standard. It's just a nice pub. They do a decent Guinness as well.
That's good. That's always good. A nice Guinness.
The owner was absolutely buzzing.
Yeah.
And I think even he had his reservations at the start as well. He was a bit like, oh, I wasn't sure what to expect. You know, they have an open mic music night, and he was like, I didn't know whether it was going to be like that or whether it was going to be something different. And after the first night, he was absolutely buzzing because, you know, a Sunday night in August, you don't really know what to expect in a local pub. I'd imagine, especially given the pubs around here, I'd imagine that 8, 9 o'clock on a Sunday night, most pubs are probably quite dead.
Yeah, and to be fair, like shout out Tony for the North 19 pub and his wife Karen as well. Yeah, I mean, like, a lot of the times in that pub, it's probably not as busy as they would like all the time. They do nights, and the thing about it is it's a proper local pub. So when events happen, people do come out. But I just think just because of the way they are, he brought his mate, his business partner, who, you know, is very kind of like, well, I don't know what the word is, not coy, but just maybe a bit standoffish, a bit cold.
I think he just didn't know what to expect, like a bit like everyone else there. Everyone else was a non-comedy person there.
So what did you expect? What did you think it'd be like?
I didn't know, because I've
But knowing me, you don't know, but I mean, like, did you just think, oh, this is Chris doing a night, or what, I don't know.
No, I knew that you were going to be fully, I know that you're not like a half measures person, so I knew that because you were doing it, I knew that you was going to have put all of the effort required into it. It's just that nights like this, in my mind anyway, they start as something small, and then they snowball, and then they gather pace, and then they get, you know, like a lot of the nights I've been to watch you.
Yeah.
I'd imagine they didn't start with, you know, 20 acts and 50 people in the audience. I'd imagine they started much smaller. But this seems to have started with a decent size anyway. Like, I've been to established nights with less people there than both of those first two nights.
Yeah.
Like, you're getting, I mean, we should start taking attendances at these things, really. But I would say there's 40 people.
Probably about 30, 40 people.
Yeah.
And the size of the room, it's about as,
yeah.
I mean, people are standing.
Yeah, I mean, like, yeah, we had, both nights, we've had standing room only.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
Which is for a Sunday night, and also, like you said about the pub itself, it's a pub in Islington, but it's not an Islington pub, if that makes
it's
sense.
A local. It's a proper local.
It's a proper
right in the middle of a, you know, residential area. It's just off the main road, Holloway Road, in between Hornsey and Holloway, right where everyone lives in the middle of estates. you know, where you get all sorts of different people.
Yeah,
that's where I grew up.
Yeah, I mean, I've been past there hundreds of times.
Yeah,
and I didn't know the pub was. I mean, I must have seen it at some point, but I didn't know the pub was there until I went in there, and I was like, oh, I didn't even realise there was a pub down here.
Yeah,
unless you live in the immediate vicinity, and by that I mean within half a mile. You probably wouldn't even know there was a pub there unless you've been in the local area or you had a reason to know there was
a pub. Well, there's a pub right next to it called the Landseer, which is usually much busier. But it's, you know, it's a nice it's not a gastro pub, but it's a, you know, the clientele is that probably of not where I grew up in the States. You know, they probably have all the teeth in their mouth in the Landseer, whereas, you know, they got young people that are from a different place and
yeah.
Usually gets quite busy, yummy mummies, families and whatnot.
You had a few locals in there. On the second night, there was actually people that from the local area that weren't any relation to you, weren't anything to do with you, had just come along because they'd obviously heard the first night was good.
Yeah, well, after the first night, like you said, I don't think they expected to, the pub really expected to much big things, really. He always talks about how with their open mic on a Tuesday, the music one, they would have a few stand-up comedians who would just do terribly. And so I think they expected just a really low-calibre level of stand-up comedy, but an entire night of just dog shit. But I know, just being in it for a year and a half, the calibre of comedians in the open mic circuit is actually pretty high. You know, it's not, obviously, Live at the Apollo levels or TV specials and stuff like that, but in terms of amateur comedians, it's very, very good. And I think, I like to think that part of it, a lot of people say that the night's a good atmosphere, it feels like it's good fun, the vibe is great, and hopefully that's, you know, I can only bring the acts, you know, I know a lot of them, I see them around doing it when I'm in the open mic, but people, you know, sometimes have good nights, sometimes have bad nights. All I can really do is try and give them a position to succeed to a degree, and that's giving the right space, the right audience, and just, I don't know, like, hopefully doing a half decent job emceeing, and it seems to be working out right.
Yeah, I think there's also a skill to, you know, and we've spoke about this as well, like, there's a skill to putting together the night and putting the acts in the right order.
Yeah.
Like, I know we said no names, but it's relevant to the conversation. The first week, somebody didn't turn up. You asked somebody to stand in, who's one of my favourite local comedians, a guy called...
Shout out Daniel Cohen.
Dan Cohen. Just a really, really funny geezer. And I really like his act as well. And a nice guy too.
Really good guy.
He just jumped in. Like, that to me was just wild. How he had his 5 minutes there, ready to go at any point. He came down to watch. He wasn't even meant to be performing.
Yeah.
And someone didn't turn up. You went, can you jump on and give us 5 minutes? He went, sweet, hold my dog. Left his dog with him.
Not his wife, come on.
Yeah. Jumped up there, smashed it, and then just went about his night as normal. And I was like, fucking hell, like that's quite impressive, the way you can just not get yourself, because from the background that I come from, like, not even the background I come from, but whenever I do something, whether it's like playing sport or whether it's giving a presentation at work or something like that, I have to get myself into that zone to be able to then perform, so to speak.
Yeah.
I don't know how good I'd be if someone just went, right, go, and he was able to do that.
Well,
I found that really,
to be fair, I know him, I know he's a good comedian. I felt okay to ask him if he could fill in because the guy didn't drop out. That may not necessarily be the case with everyone, but with him certainly. But when you do it enough and you repeat, you know, the magic trick of doing stand-up is repeating the same shit you've been saying for a long time.
How long has he been at it for? Just about a year? About the
same year. Yeah, maybe about a year, maybe less. I'm not quite sure. Maybe less than that, actually. But, you know, he knows his material, which is good. And also, you know, I don't know, he's a good comedian. He's got some good jokes.
He is.
He's ready to go with five. Like, if someone came to me randomly and be like, can you do 5 minutes of material? I can do that any time now.
Yeah.
You know, and that's part of it.
And do you think there's a lot to be said for... Because I've said one thing with you from the very, very start.
You said many things about me.
I've said many things about you. Some of them I won't say in public, but...
Don't say them to me, please.
Even from the very start, when maybe your material was a bit raw, you've always looked comfortable on the stage. And I think this applies in sport a lot as well. When someone's good at something, or someone's a natural at something, they just look comfortable doing what they want to do. There's some comedians you see, and when they go on stage, they don't look comfortable physically. They look very nervous. And I think you can almost tell now, from having watched it. I mean, I've watched more comedy in the last year.
Yeah.
because of you.
To be fair, I probably have as well.
Well, you've watched more comedy than most people do in a lifetime, yeah, in the last year. But I can almost tell now when someone goes up, like, yeah, that's a guy who's comfortable.
Yeah.
Like some guys literally just come and just sit on the corner of the table and they're having a conversation with the audience as if they're chatting to their mate in the pub.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, you automatically think, right, this is going to be good. And then there's other people that don't. And I think people like yourself and Dan are people that just look at ease with what they're doing. They look like they're almost up the bar having a chat with
someone. Yeah, I mean, there's probably a lot of different things that go into that. I think if I could try and pin a similarity between me and Dan is that, like, we're just up for it. Like, so, but, you know, just up for anything kind of thing. Imagine you went, you know, you're going football training, right? And then someone turns up who's never played football before, or two people turn up, right? And I don't know, have you ever had that situation where you get people that are quite new to the team, new to training potentially, and they're nervous, and then they're not really trying, you know, it's, they're not getting involved in training as much. If I came to one of your trainings and never really played football, I'd be getting involved, I'd be talking, yeah, still, I'd be trying, you know.
When I was at uni, I used to run a thing called Give It A Go Football, which is where you basically just set up a few pitches and people that have never played competitively before can just come and basically have a kick around on a Tuesday, yeah, night. Me and my mate Andy used to do it. And we would literally, it started off, they wanted us to actually do a bit of coaching, but it became obvious that if we would start sort of like running coaching sessions, people weren't going to come.
Yeah.
No one wants to turn up after a long day of uni and be coached by someone who's the same age.
Unless they want to get coached.
Unless they genuinely want to be coached, but usually people that want to be coached are playing competitively.
Exactly.
So we ended up just like, we'd set up a couple of 8-a-side pitches and just let them play. And I know exactly what you mean. There was people that come along who you could tell, like, they really wanted to get involved and have a go. And then there was other people that kind of went and then probably got there and thought, I sort of wish I wasn't here, sort of thing.
Yeah, I mean, with my one at least, I think one of the advantages I had, because yesterday I did MC in another gig, and if I can give myself any credit, I think it's making people feel like they can be comfortable to just go up and perform. Because at both nights, respectfully, I think there's a lot of people that have definitely, like, performed above average. You know, every one of us can have good nights and one of us can have bad nights, right? And I've had some bad ones. This week, it's been fucking excellent. But sometimes it's like, the thing that you're trying to do is just, like in sports, like in anything, is consistency. But certainly at my gig, almost everyone is getting laughs all the time. And you've been to enough where, you know, sometimes half of them are, or maybe less than that. And only, yeah, the ones that are really refined and have really, yeah, tight fives and are good comedians do well. But in a new, you know, in an environment where it's supposed to be for new comedians, you want to be able to, I want to be able to provide a place where they're going to get some good feedback for their efforts. You know, don't laugh at them and patronise them, which I don't think is happening. But when there's someone that's got a genuinely good joke or something that, you know, maybe doesn't make sense in terms of the entirety of the set, but punchlines in and of themselves is what really you're trying to focus on as a young comedian, because it's really hard to build a narrative and make a whole story. When you go to other gigs, like proper ones, you really got to be much tighter. It's got to be more coherent. It's got to make sense for the punchline to land also. If you just do punchlines, sometimes they just don't work. Whereas, you know, on my night, the OM, you can maybe get no laughs sort of in one joke, and the next one you'll get a big boom. And at least there's something where you feel like, all right, this was great, I can build off of that. You feel like you've had some good feedback, it was a good effort. And it just, because the hardest thing about it is actually going back up and doing it again, like again and again and again. It's hard to subject yourself to things that you're not very good at. Some people do that all the time, some people don't. And to actually get up and perform again is the only way that you're going to get better and improve your skills as a comedian. And that's basically what I'm trying to do with it.
Listening to you speak there, and that was quite a long monologue, but going back to the very start...
Oh, excuse me. Fucking hell.
No, what I mean is...
Put the timer on.
What I mean is there's a lot to remember from everything you went through there, but at the very start you said people are performing above average.
Yeah.
And I think that is where you have to give credit to three different groups of people. First of all, the pub and the pub owner. Second of all, the audience.
Yeah.
And then thirdly, you. All three of those groups of people are putting people in an environment that's conducive to them succeeding. And by succeeding, I mean getting laughs, getting punchlines, and performing well. It's the equivalent of, and we're going to have to find another thing to relate it back to other than sport, but it's the equivalent of if you turn up at an away game and the dressing room's freezing cold, there's nowhere for everyone to change together, the pitch is shit, your kits are still damp from the week before, and you know you're wearing molds.
So fucked when you just
you're wearing molds and you should be wearing.
Isn't it the worst? Like, sorry, isn't it the worst when you just get the kit out and you're like, whose fucking responsibility was it to wash it? Stinks like shit, and just like I can't even.
I played for one team in North London that I won't name, and I'm sure the kits got washed about three times a season. Like, but when that happens, straight away. I mean, you might go out and have an alright game, but straight away you're like, oh, I should have stayed at Inn and watched. I should be down in the pub now. You straight away you're not in the mindset. Whereas when you turn up and everything goes right, and you have a nice big dressing room, and the kits are nice, and first game of the season, and the pitch is nice and smooth, you think, right, now everything's in. Everything that I need to be there for me to play well is there. And if you go and play shit, it's your own fault.
But that's where I think, like, going to me and Dan earlier, and certainly for myself with the mentality of, I'm trying to strip away as many factors as possible, because all I need to go up is just do my stuff. You know, whether I walk into a room where there's four or five people, or there's 30, 40 people, or on Monday when there's 200 plus people.
If you speak about Monday.
I will do, yeah, 100%. I'm talking about this week for sure, man. I'm going to be a star. I'm going to be a fucking star, Rory.
We'll give ourselves another 4 minutes on the OM. And then we need to talk about Monday.
Why have you become Time Lord all of a sudden?
Well, because
are you in a hurry or something?
No, I just don't want to run out of time and not get to talk about
what Monday. Time? It's Saturday.
I think people are going to be clicking on videos and seeing that.
No one is listening to this.
No one is listening to us talk for 4 hours. I can tell you that.
Someone will.
Who?
Someone fucking our will. Our mums. Yeah. Not your mum.
No, my mum has not got time for that.
Oh, love you, Linda.
These two Billy bullshitters.
Fuck it. He's going to listen to these two arseholes talking about Corbyn and.
Go on.
But yeah, no, I think that's just thinking about it out loud is, I was on this, we're going to talk about it, I'll blend it in. I went to this gig on Thursday in Cambridge, right? And it was this gong show that this night. It was their first one. It's a proper comedy gig that they go around, and the reason I went was because I wanted to showcase myself to the guy who books the night, so hopefully he'll put me on, you know.
So how did you come across him?
Facebook. A lot of these stuff you find on Facebook, the Comedy Collective. There's all these groups if you're a comic who's starting out, and that's basically where people post all the time for stuff, for spots and whatnot. And it is quite competitive, but you know, if they don't know you, if they don't see you, then it's much harder to get spots. And so I went out to this one called Big Deal Comedy by a guy called Jason.
And how did you get out there? Drive?
I took him. So I was working in the afternoon in my office, and I'd seen this on Facebook. I was like, I've not really got much to do. How do I get from Cambridge to home? And there's a train from Finsbury Park.
Yeah,
straight to Cambridge.
It's not the one that goes past it. You can go from Liverpool Street or King's Cross. One was a King's Cross one.
And then, so I just tapped in, innit, to go to Cambridge, thinking, like, I can just tap out. Well, I was like,
Instagram,
you go to fucking Finsbury Park, you tap in, wherever you go, you should be able to tap out.
No, this is the last place you can tap out on
TFL. That's what
Chesnut is the last place.
So then I get to the station, and I'm trying to tap out, and the guy's like, oh, you can't tap it, we don't do tap in from Finsbury Park. I was like,
Did you literally tell him you'd come from Finsbury Park as well?
Well, there's nothing I could do, right, because charge me for the ticket or whatever, because I was putting my card.
How long was the train and how much did it cost?
Well, the train cost the cost of whatever tap in one time in Finsbury Park, because what he said was, he opened it up and he goes, oh, just goes over to those machines and buy a ticket. I was like, yeah, no worries, I'll do that now. I walked over to the ticket machine, looked around, he turned the other way, I just left.
Oh, you must have known you weren't going to pay 20 quid for that.
Of course not. I had to pay on the way back though.
How much?
28 quid. So if I would have got there and back,
60 quid round trip.
If I would have paid on the way there, thank God I fucking didn't. Yeah. For a 5 minute spot in a gong show in a pub and theatre.
That's what people make me laugh when they go, yeah, you can commute from Cambridge and you can work in central London. Yeah, but what, 60 notes a day?
Yeah.
300 quid a week? How much am I getting paid if I'm commuting from Cambridge?
And overpriced. But anyway, the main reason I went was, because it was a gong show, I thought, well, I went to Manchester on Monday, which we'll get into, and just thinking, all right, I'm doing some good stuff here. Went to this gong show and it was really, really small, but in the front row.
How many people?
Maybe about 25, 30 people.
Okay. In a big venue though.
Really? Much bigger. You could probably get about 50, 60 people in there.
Okay.
And in this front row, right directly in front of you, there was these, they're not going to hear this, it's just straight up arseholes. Right? They must have think this shit was King Gong.
What were they? What they assholes in the sense that they were there to heckle? Or,
yeah.
Was it in a pub or was it in like a proper?
It's a pub and theatre, so it's a pub, and then upstairs they have this little theatre stage. With you know, it's not that big.
And people would come out on a Monday night. Was it Monday?
Thursday.
On a Thursday night in Cambridge, and decided I'm going to sit in the front row of a comedy show.
Yeah.
And I'm going to be a prick.
Yeah. Yeah. So they were, you know, boring, boring.
What?
Just yelling shit. What's your name? How do you spell it? That's a shit joke.
To everyone or to like?
To pretty much everyone, yeah.
I'd have gone out and I'd just attacked them verbally from the second I
Yeah, left. I mean, I've lost my point now because you keep interrupting me. But yeah, there you go.
So go on. I want to know how it.
So the original point was around giving people an opportunity to get good feedback, right? And all the factors, you know, if you went into a changing room and if it's too cold, if the kit's shit, right? Because I've subjected myself and I go in with the attitude of I'm always going to perform regardless, right? Because of these hecklers that were right in front of me, I just felt like I was much better equipped at being able to handle them. And which meant that I made the 5 minutes, I almost won this gong show. The person who won it was flawless in dealing with these hecklers because clearly she's comfortable in doing that too. Whereas the other comedians that was on there had a much tougher time dealing with these hecklers because they need perfect conditions to be able to perform well. And, you know, as much as I like the OM, I want to be able to make it a good environment where all the factors for people that do get affected by, you know, X, Y, and Z enjoy being there and can actually perform at their best. But sometimes, like, I don't know, I just feel like I go into these places and have a generally good gig regardless because my only real focus is on myself to a degree because I trust the material, I trust what I'm doing. If there's 3 or 4 people there's still people there to perform. Where sometimes, you know, people shit on gigs because there's not enough people, you know, it's a dark room. They'll make up, the audience is bad, they'll make up all sorts of reasons as to why they're not performing as well. I just think that, for me, it's not necessarily conducive for me, but I know that it's something that people want, and I certainly want to create that environment so at least people can not have to worry about, oh, this room's shit. They can just worry about the material. And that's why I think that's one of the reasons why everyone's performing above average.
So do you think, in the way you dealt with the hecklers, did you deal with them by attacking them, or did you deal with them just by ignoring them, or did you deal with them by...
Well, you have to acknowledge them. I think if there's hecklers there, I think one of the worst things to do, you know, you said some people just feel like they're not comfortable on stage. When hecklers start going and they start taking them off their course, you can see that they physically start shrinking. For every audience member, it's always tough. You always got to give that air of confidence and that you're in control. As soon as you start showing any frailty, like it's in sports and everything, it's like as soon as you start showing a little bit of weakness, then the audience isn't going to enjoy watching it. The hecklers are only going to be worse. Whereas you have to have the ability to go back and forward with them. But if you always expect the perfect conditions, it's just not reasonable. You know, that's why teams always prefer playing at home because the conditions are always the same. Whereas when they go away from home, if it's a bad changing room, a bad journey, some players can't even perform. Whereas some people, it doesn't matter where they play, just throw a ball, do whatever. And for me, as long as there's a mic and there's someone there in the audience watching me, I don't give a fuck who it is. I'm going to give as best I can. And also, I'm not going to let people in the audience try and shake me off my spot because that's what they're looking for. Like, sometimes people are just like bullies as well, to a degree. And you kind of have to find a balance. You can't be too offensive. You have to bring them on side, and then hopefully they'll stop talking as much. They might even add to your gig. You know, they may even make you look better than what you are. But you have to be able to exist in different environments, I think, if you're going to be successful. But from the grassroots level, from the new comedians, new comics nights, new acts and all that stuff, it's good to have a place where you feel like you can actually just, you know, build your skills.
Yeah, I just don't know what the mentality of someone who... I guess because it's not something I would ever do, I just don't really understand the mentality of someone who goes out and thinks, yeah, what I'm going to do today is I'm going to make a concerted effort to fuck up this person's gig. It's just a really weird mindset.
But you absolutely have pals that are like that.
Yeah, I do have pals.
Yeah?
No, I don't
so
know.
So take some of your pals, yeah? Get in their head, them dickheads.
I know you're talking
you
about.
You know who I'm talking about. Get in their head and just... But that's what it is, though. You know, some people are weird. Like, I don't know why people go to a comedy show and just want to be miserable. You know, some people just go there and just...
Remember that?
Yeah, I know. Yeah. Just miserable. And they were a comic, too. but yeah.
Yeah, I've been to one. What we just acknowledged there, like there was one where this person in the front row, just from the start, you could just tell she just weren't having it, and she was a comic, and she sat there with like a face like a slapped ass throughout the whole 2-3 hour show, and just yeah, it's just.
But it's one thing I've been thinking about lately, because I know you said let's not talk about sports, but I think we're both into sports. I analogize a lot to sports with what I'm doing, and generally in life, because I think it's a good example. But one of the things I've been thinking about is that I've always loved team sports, and part of the reason is because it's very easy to have a group mentality and fit in that way. Whereas now I feel like I'm starting to get a really good understanding of what golfers are like, or someone that plays snooker. Or darts, even. Like you gave a really good example for me as to why I felt like I didn't do too well in my first gig, because I was nervous, and how my standards are higher. So even if I perform at a 5, 6, or 7, because my standards are higher, even though it's not to the standard I want, it's still deliverable. And everyone, it's just such a diverse group of people who view stand-up comedy in the ways that they view it. This gig in Manchester, for instance, right? So I went to the Frog and Bucket, which is a big, big comedy gig here. Big comedy venue in Manchester.
First like, overnighter?
Yeah. Well, I went to Brighton, but I stayed at a friend's afterwards. But, you know, I went to work on Monday, took the train up, got the shittiest hotel of all time, windowless.
Window? Is that even allowed?
I know, man. Who the fuck knows, man? But, so I went there, and, you know, I've been trying to chase a good clip for a while, because if you get a good clip, you can send that out, get much better gigs if it's at a proper venue and things like that.
How long is it meant to be? Like when you say a good clip, you mean like a good 2 minutes? Like
5, at least, I would imagine. Right, 5, okay. Yeah. No one's going to watch like you for 15 minutes, but they just need a sample of where you're at. And so if I've got the Frog and Bucket insignia behind me, or if you was at the Comedy Store, and they see that I've got a 5-minute clip, well, I've clearly lasted that long, they could just see me in a proper venue where there's going to be a couple hundred people. I felt relatively confident. I have been feeling confident for months, because I feel like I'm getting better and better and much tighter, and I think I'm ready to make it to the next level. I feel like I'm at the top end of the open mic scene, and I want to start doing these professional gigs where, for me, it will be open spots where you wouldn't get paid, but it'd be outside of London with no bringers, you know, no stayers, just performing in front of actual audience members. How they get them, I've no clue. Do my 5 minutes, right? Someone else that I know from London came up as well, a guy called Ollie Fox. Didn't know that, not at the same time, we just randomly booked it, and he was like, yeah, I did it. He didn't expect to see anyone that he knew, and I think he might have did that on purpose to a degree. But I know there's at least one guy who's an absolute monster here, but I didn't know anyone else. I'm last in the second half. There's 3 sections, last in the second section. Mm-hmm. Up to that point, everyone's just pretty much eating dog shit. Just no one's doing well. One black guy passes at the end of the first section. He was okay. When it got to my point, I got like 2 or 3 rounds of applause, laughing, everything's going well. During the break, people are just telling me how I was the best at that point. Oh, you're definitely up for winning. I felt like I had a good shot at it, right? Which was really, really exciting. As I was performing, my legs started shaking more. I was getting adrenaline. Because I was like,
you knew it was going well.
Yeah, man. I was like, this is going really, really well. And I just need to just slow down, calm down, do the thing. Do my comedy. Goes really, really well. Probably, you know, you talk about overperforming. Certainly, that was the best gig I've ever done, or up there with it, for sure.
I was going to ask you if it's top three. Like, you're saying top...
No. Top three, easy. Okay. Easy, top three, easy. Not even close, because I thought that one you came to, I think, in Third Comedy, even though it was a small pub, that was just... I don't know what was going on that night, boy, yeah, but it was just on fire. I was en fuego. Do you know what I mean? Like, I was fucking killing it, boy.
I don't know what happened that night.
Fuck knows, because I tried that new stuff again, and it weren't working the same. But something about
mood.
Yeah, everyone knew me. Like, again, it's friends and
sunny
shit.
Day.
Just whatever. Vibing. Yeah, great spot. I was just like, everything I was saying, I just couldn't say anything wrong. Yeah. And so, yeah, I had a fucking fantastic one at this Frog and Bucket, right? But the thing with it, in terms of this individual approach and, you know, what are people thinking? And certainly with my mindset, one of the hardest things about it is that people tell you to your face what they like and what they don't like. And I've really got to be able to figure out how to deal with the fact that there's going to be a lot of people that don't like me. Because one of the bits of feedback I seem to be getting as of late from individuals is that they're like, oh yeah, your stuff is really, really good, really, really good, but you know, you maybe do a little bit too much black stuff.
By black stuff, what do they mean?
Fuck knows. What are you on about? What do they mean? Look at me, I'm black. I don't know.
Just that's weird. That's like, I wouldn't say that your act is like.
They're acting like I'm going up there with a fucking spear and shield. They fucking talking about.
It's weird because the thing is, I don't think you'd hear that about, for example, Paul Chowdhury, one of my favourite comedians in the world. He does a lot of Indian stuff.
I thought about this, yeah.
He does a lot of British Indian stuff. Yeah. Like, he is a British Indian.
Yeah.
He does a lot of cussing in Punjabi. He does a lot of picking on any Indians that are in the crowd.
Yeah.
But he is unashamedly a British Indian comedian.
Yeah.
He's a fucking genius. Some of the stuff he has, like some of the stuff he says, some of the stuff he does, some of his mannerisms, he's just brilliant. He's a phenomenal comedian. But you wouldn't necessarily hear someone go to him, well, I think you do a bit too much Indian stuff.
Well, I thought that, like,
he's an Indian.
Yeah, and I was like, I wanted to, I almost put like a little poll on Instagram, just because out of curiosity, why, does anyone say, oh, that person does too many Chinese jokes, or too many Indian jokes, or too many women jokes, or, you know, it's
posh
like,
jokes, that seems to be a thing.
But yeah, I guess so, maybe it's that.
Just going up and just joking about how posh they are.
Yeah, or, yeah. Like, and it's just an interesting one because actually this was it, the funny thing about it was the first time a black person told me this. And I was like, oh, do you know what? I felt like saying to a, no black person would ever say this to me in London. It's so funny how like, they wouldn't though.
She's not one talks to each other in London.
Like. She's probably the only one. That's it, isn't it? She's like, she's hanging around a load of white people.
Was she a comic?
Nah, she was an audience member.
How many people would you say are in there?
In the Fog and Bucket?
Yeah.
Oh gosh.
Hundreds?
Yeah, a couple hundred. Yeah, 200, 250.
What, and you go and mingle with the crowd afterwards?
Nah, just going out for a cigarette and like walking by because you walk through them and just people were just being, when you mash, people come up to you and tell you how well you've done.
I know. So that's one of the things. You had about five people.
Fucking love it. Like, I always tell my girlfriend, it's like, I'm the man tonight. Like, it's when people going up and dapping you up and being like, that's when you know you've done well. When people avoid you, don't make eye contact, that's when you know it's not been great.
How many times has that happened?
Oh, many a time. It happened yesterday.
What did you do gig last night?
Yeah, I was MCing. It was a bit of a dull night. I probably wasn't at my best, if I'm being honest, but, you know, it is what it is.
Did you eat shit or was it just average?
Everyone ate shit. This is the way it goes sometimes. You know what I mean? There was about eight audience members. It's fucking boiling. Like, you know, the heat. I had a headache in the second half because of just.
Did you have a beer as well?
I had a beer and then I had a cider and I probably should have got some water. So that was make a mistake. But yeah, I just with in terms of my mentality with it and people's approach, you know, it's all individual. That's what's so interesting about it. And I think that because it's so individual, it's very easy in a team to be like, we're all on the same path. Because that's the idea that you're trying to get to. And that's why when you look at another team, you say they play like shit or they do this. It's because they're not doing it like you. But because we're all individuals, there's just much more, there's more opportunity for people to kind of disagree with your philosophy or approach. And it's just how do you manage that? A lot of people go into it for one reason and they're struggling with the fact that no one's laughing at them. You know, they're thinking about things they shouldn't be concerned with. And the job is, at the end of the day, you got to make people laugh. I understand it's about self-expression. It's something to do to kind of build your confidence if you want to try it. But after trying it, if you want to kind of pursue it, it's all got to be about trying to get people to laugh. And you cannot be overly precious around how you approach it, because if you don't do it, you don't do it. But if you do it consistently, and if more people like you than you don't, you'll be all right.
How do you feel about the kind of, because you said like you need to not be, I think it was precious with what you said about the unsolicited advice. I think unsolicited advice when it comes from your mates is usually coming from like a sort of positive place, or will usually come, it won't be unsolicited because you'll go, oh, what do you think? But I find it really weird that strangers are really comfortable coming up to you and just giving you kind of unsolicited feedback on your performance. But then it happens in sport, doesn't it? People come up to you and go, yeah, I didn't think you played very well today. And you're like, did I fucking ask you? Like, I know if I played well or not. And
yeah.
It happens in all sports as well that I come across. And it's kind of the same with comedy. Like, people are very comfortable walking up to you as someone who they don't know. Or maybe because you've been on stage for 5 minutes talking about yourself, they think they know you now. But it sort of surprises me how confident and how comfortable people are to just go, do you know what, I'm going to go tell that guy that he does too much black stuff.
Yeah, yeah. Well, the thing is, right, like, I don't know, I think we both do the same. If we talk to strangers, It's all. I don't know if you're mindful about it, but you just keep it positive. You know, you big people up. You don't just like tell them what you like about them, or don't tell them anything at all. The interesting thing about this is that some people come and tell you what they don't like, and that I can't. I don't know. I have no clue where that fucking mentality comes from. It's because they think they know. Stand-up comedy is weird because at least with sports, you can have a bit of separation to a degree where you're like, these are things that I can't do, right? And that's maybe where it gets a bit weird. But with stand-up comedy, I guess a lot of people assume that they can do it if they had the guts. Everyone's problem is, I just couldn't get up there. But get up there. That's the easy part, getting up on the stage. The hardest part is making people laugh. And that's why you say with people that don't know, I actually find it much more difficult to take the criticism from the people I do. The closer you are to me, the harder it hits. Because for me, it's like, why are you saying that to me? Because you know who I am? Why would you, you know I'm either sensitive or you know that this is what I'm trying. You're seeing my journey. So what would be the point in either coming to me to say something? Because the amount of time that I've spent, you know how much effort I'm putting into this.
It's insane. The amount of hours you're putting, not even just the actual doing the comedy, the amount of hours you're spending doing the admin and doing the videos and doing the...
Thinking about it.
It's nuts.
Yeah, so if someone who comes who's a stranger, they're somewhat ignorant, but like, and that I just find more interesting because usually it's like older white women, if I'm being honest.
Really?
They're the ones that say it. Yeah, older white women, and then maybe a couple of black people have said it here and there.
The exact same thing, or just
you're just doing too many black jokes. But it's interesting because I'm like, it's not. It's like maybe 2.5 minutes of black stuff, but then I don't even know. I don't even know what that means, but because. All I'm doing is talking about my perspective, and I'm black. You know, you know me. I've never been someone that has invested a lot of myself in the ideas of being black. But since starting this, certainly, and even like these jobs I've had in the last few years, it's made me definitely more mindful around what it is to be black.
I think that's maybe down to the fact that you're entering spaces now where you are different. And by different, I don't mean different because of your skin colour, but I mean you're mixing with people that, you know, in my experience, a lot of comics, they come from outside London, they've moved to London to either do their comedy or they've moved to London for work or something, and they're not used to just growing up. Like we were speaking earlier about growing up in London, regardless of whether you live on the outskirts like I did or whether you live in like zone 1 or 2 like you did. It was just normal to have people with black parents, Irish parents, Asian parents. In my part of North London, in Enfield, there was a lot of Greeks, a lot of Turks. There's also a lot of Indians. You know, there's a lot of Caribbeans. In South London, there's a lot more Africans. And it's just...
Too many.
It's just normal. It's just normal when you grow up in London to just be used to people that are different from you.
I think
now there's a lot more Eastern Europeans in the you know... And these people that come to London to do comedy or maybe come to London as adults and hang around in predominantly white offices, predominantly white middle class social arenas, they're maybe just not used to being around people that are different from them.
Yeah, I think it's understanding actually like diversity. You know what I mean? Because the thing is, being around my people, I always use this term my people. I've started saying it at the beginning of my gigs, and people like my people, what I mean by that is where you come from. So, you know, you as my friend, one of my best friends, we're not friends because I'm a black guy and you're a white guy. We are friends because of how we get on as people, right?
Because we have a lot of shared experiences.
Yeah, and because of where we're from, we can see people that are different colours, different cultures to a degree. But it's not even different culture, it's different races, different types of background. But generally the culture is the same. Because if you walk around your area here, yeah, that might be a Pakistani guy, but probably similar culture where you guys would have a shared level of understanding.
Probably went to a similar school to me.
Exactly.
In similar places.
So then if I'm talking about this stuff about like person of colour and being black and this, you'll understand what I'm talking about to a degree. And you're not necessarily seeing it as this, oh, that's just some black jokes. This is a joke that a black man saying about his experience. And you can understand that because you've also been around it. You may not have experienced yourself, but you've been around it. The people that say that are the people that don't know how to deal with diversity. It's like, again, I've been in the professional world now for what seems like the last 5 years, and they don't know how to deal with diversity. They don't know how to deal with me because they don't know how to deal with the differences between people so much so they're hyper-focused on it. People are hyper focused on the fact that my comedy has black themes, but they're not really listening to what I'm saying.
Yeah,
it's not about being black. Like the person of color bit is, and the blacklist bit is talking about the absurdity in ways that people have boxed in black people. But yeah, it's more about actually you lot than it is about us lot. Whereas they're just saying, "Oh, you're just talking about black being black." Well, it's just my perspective, though.
Yeah, I mean, you've only got to go to somewhere like Devon, and witness how people react when they see someone who's different from them.
And it's touching your hair.
No, it's
people tend to shy away.
I had a massive. Oh, you're talking about that? I thought you were talking about me. And I had a Devon, massive McDonald's just before I was about to burp. But yeah, they just, like you said, they might be very liberal, in inverted commas, and very well-meaning.
Ah, well, what is it? Words are words, liberal.
They don't know how to act around anyone different from them. And I see it, and it's really funny because my older brother lives there, and he's from South London.
Yeah.
And the things he tells me that he hears people say, or how people react and stuff, it's really funny because he views it from a lens of someone who grew up and worked in London.
What do you mean?
He's like, oh, you know, if a black person moved into the local village, or, oh, there's an Asian family down here on holiday, and just different anecdotes. I can't think of any specific at the moment, but just how very in a bubble they are, the ones that are from there and are born and raised in South Devon, and are just...
Like, what would it need to be about someone or family that would move in around this area where you think everyone would talk to them, like, oh, that's the guy with the eye patch, you know what I mean? Is that the guy with
I was going to say, if we got someone with an eye patch, are we talking about this block? Because this block's funny.
If a house full of Africans moved next door, it's not like it would be the talk of the town.
No, you know. there's an African family in this block.
But do you know what I'm saying? Like,
if someone moved in who was, like, for example, at the minute,
the posh family. If there was like a posh people, you'd be like, have you seen the posh family?
I am the posh family.
Yeah, fuck you, wish.
I am the posh family.
You fucking wish.
But like at the minute, there's an old elderly lady, and it's a funny story, but I shouldn't be laughing. I think I told you about that.
I'm laughing already.
She's got like mid to end stage dementia.
Okay.
Right? And so she doesn't know who anyone is, and she doesn't know where she is, and she has a carer come every day, but for about 3 hours. The rest of the time, she's left to her own devices. So I was in Tesco's the other day and just saw her wandering around Tesco's, and I was thinking, she ain't meant to be out on her own.
Yeah.
Like, and then so I then went to work, and I'm texting Seth the whole rest of the day saying, has she come back yet? Has she come back yet? Because I saw her and was in too much of a rush to get involved.
Yeah.
But that's the talk of around here at the minute. Like, she tried to, there's a load of garages behind. She tried to break into the garages the other night at 10 at night. This is like a woman in her 80s.
Yeah.
And she like looks through people's letterboxes and stuff like that. That's what gets people talking around here.
Yeah.
But she's lived here for like 20 odd years. Like, I don't know if there's anyone, unless it was like someone with an eye patch, which I'm laughing. Again, it ain't funny. But if someone with an eye patch moved in, that would probably get people talking.
Yeah.
But I don't think any type of person moving in here could get people talking, because there is every type of person in Chester.
But if I moved to a town or village that's outside of London, right? And like, I've been to a lot of places outside of London, places that are predominantly white. Like, people look at you, but people look at you anyway. And then it's just one of those things where it's just you know, I remember going to Doncaster years ago, and I was dancing, right?
Was you in Doncaster?
I used to have a friend that lived there.
All right.
And we were out on a night out, and I'm dancing, and you know, I'm fucking making shapes, because that's what I do. Well, I used to, man. I'm getting old.
Now the only shake you're making
is
on your back.
That's a good one. Well done. And I remember chatting to these guys, and he was like, oh, where are you from? I said, I'm from London. He's like, I knew it. Because of my dancing.
Oh, I was a black guy dancing. Because you was black.
It was black, and it was the body popping and the waving, and Usher was on. So, you know, man's got to do it all. Yeah, come on now. Come on. Got to let it burn, innit?
Oh, you literally nicked that. Oh, my God.
Quicker.
Yeah, that was quick.
Yeah, but it's just an interesting thing, really, like having to... It's a weird thing I have to confront, really, because the problem is that I'm really, really enjoying the stuff that I'm talking about. I never went into it expecting to talk about anything around being black to this degree that I am now. But the issue is that I really, really enjoy it. And even a lot of the ideas I think around has those themes. And I'm not going to avoid them. You know, there are people that like it. Monday was an excellent, excellent night. If one or two people say that, I can take that. You know, whereas that some people, we were talking earlier about, you know, being in the right conditions. If one person comes up to them and may say a comment that they're not too keen on, they're out. You know, or it's going to rattle them, or it's going to... And I could be that way. I reckon if I did this in my 20s, it would be much, much harder to navigate from an emotional standpoint. But I think the reason why I'm able to do it the way that I'm doing it and be as consistent as I am and as I don't know, like, it seems to be going well, you know. And it's because I'm just going in there with the intention that I want it to want to have, but I'm not being too sensitive. I'm not going to let anything that's going to deter me as much. Because I think I'm capable.
Yeah, I don't think you should ever stop doing what you're enjoying doing because one person...
What if that's murdering?
That's a Dan Cohen joke, that is.
Oh, yeah,
That is the sort of thing he would say. No, well, I'm talking material-wise now.
Yeah.
There is no way... I've got 2 points to make on it. First one is there's no way you should stop doing...
We'll run that time, just one point. I'm joking.
There's no way you should stop doing what you're doing from a material standpoint because one person doesn't like it. That's my first point. The second point
Thank you.
Think of your... So, you love Peter Kay, I love Peter Kay. He's maybe probably both in both our top threes, right?
Yeah, he's up there for sure.
And he's probably done 1,000 gigs in his life, maybe more, maybe 5,000.
Gosh,
gigs.
Yeah.
I guarantee you that even when he was playing stadiums, there was never a point where every person in the building laughed at every joke.
Yeah.
You cannot hit a six off every ball.
No.
Like, so the bigger you get, and the more successful you get, and the bigger audiences you play to, there's going to be more people that don't like what you're saying, but they're also going to be a smaller percentage of a bigger pot. If you're playing to 10 people and one person don't like it, that's 10% of people don't like it. If you're playing to 1,000 people and 50 people don't like it, I don't know what percent that is, but it's a lot lower. Do you see what I'm saying?
But if you think about like a footballer, for instance, and we could have maybe, take Yaya Touré for instance, right? I could be like, man, I love Yaya Touré, man. He's so good at like scoring goals. He's so good at fucking hitting it. And you're like, nah, great passer. Like his passing is, that's why you like him. I like him because of his shooting. Someone else might like him because he's dribbling or defending.
Yeah.
It's the same guy.
Yeah.
So this person, it's weird. The person was telling me how much they enjoyed it. It was just too many black jokes. So it's like, well, did you like it or not? Was it effective or not?
She came and spoke to you, so she definitely liked
it. And she really, really liked it. She said I was one of the best. I was the best up to that point. Like,
that's a dub, as the kids call it.
Yeah.
But
the mentality is, like, let's not focus on the negative. Let's not focus on the people that aren't necessarily laughing, or even if it's a point that comes across as negative. That's just their observation of it. Like, I can't be... Yeah, maybe it's easy to say now because I'm not in it right now. Sometimes when you hear certain things, it's hard to take. But in large part, you just got to be able to take all those factors away that we said. Take as many factors away as you can. As long as you're being effective, know what you're trying to do. Being a stand-up comic is making people laugh. That is the be-all and end-all.
Yeah.
Now, how you want to do that is up to you, yeah? But you can't then get upset when people... If you're effective, you can't get upset with people that say they don't like you because I got laughs. I'm getting spots. People like it. If you're not getting laughs... Maybe you need to look at what you're doing and just stop saying that people are, you know, it gives you an excuse to say, this is why it's not working. It's because people just don't like black comedy. But that's not true because one person said it or two or three. It's working. You know, I'm getting laughs and that's the aim at the end of the day. The laughs I want to get seems to, I want to say something about it. I'm not a one-line artist. I'm not going to do some like punchlines that, which I find funny, but I just can't do those kind of jokes. I just want to talk about something.
Yeah, I think if everyone just did purely stuff that they find funny, I think most people's acts would get really weird, and we see that. I mean, it happens. I've seen it. Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
My two fucking eyes.
I've been there. I've been at gigs where it's got quite uncomfortable.
Oh.
And you can tell someone thinks they're being hilarious.
That I don't get.
There was one me and Mark, you probably won't even remember it. I'm not going to name no one, but there was one me and Mark went to watch you on a Saturday night.
Yeah, I know which one you're talking about.
It was quiet for a Saturday night. It was in King's Cross.
Yeah.
And that got weird. That got weird to the point where it was silence and it was almost tunnel vision. Like, it was just me and the comic in the room. Like, it's almost like everything else had blacked out.
But then they start doing that thing where they're looking up in the sky and they're looking around. It's like, you know, I don't know.
I'd say it's as uncomfortable for the audience in a situation like that as it is for the comic.
And it probably is. But again, amateur comedians, you know what I mean? It's like, this is what it is. This is why so many people are so... quick to get out of it, because it can be uncomfortable sometimes. Like yesterday, you know, it could have been...
Was it uncomfortable yesterday, or was it just...
Yeah, at times. I made people feel uncomfortable. Like,
can you think of any examples?
There was this guy who was... He was a father-in-law of this guy that was in the audience. He was from Palmer's Green. So his father-in-law came from Canada, right? Yeah. And I said, oh, what do you think of your son-in-law? And he goes, yeah, he's good. And he goes, so you've come to visit her and your daughter came from Canada to the UK to live with him? He's like, yeah. And so you like your son-in-law, even though he made her came? Like, you know.
Oh.
Is it that bad?
Not that bad.
I said it was there for the taking.
It was. And on a different night, it probably would have got a laugh.
It probably wouldn't on
going badly.
Yeah.
Did anyone laugh or did you get a groan?
Oh, it's groans. It was just, it might, uncomfortable.
Animal. How much time we got left? We going on to our five-a-side yet?
We got plenty of time. Yeah, but overall, this week was excellent for me. The OM is going really well. I think stand-up comedy is going pretty well. I'd said to Dan as well, like, we should get him on the pod.
Oh, 1,000,000%.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, 100%. He's an interesting guy. He's
yeah. Yeah, I can't wait. We're going on a little van trip in a couple of weeks. He's got an RV. We're not sure yet. It depends on the weather. But he's got an RV where we'll stay in.
He's a bloke who the majority of his material is about killing people as well. And you've decided to go on a van trip.
I'll fucking bang him up. You think man's going to have me?
I reckon he would.
Fuck off.
He's about 50.
I'm from the streets.
He's in his 40s.
Yeah.
Trust me.
You think he'll have me?
I reckon he'd tie you up.
Yeah, maybe.
I reckon if you two... If it came down to it, I'm backing him all day long.
What?
Yeah.
Why? I'll bang you up right now. What are you on about?
Your bark's worse than your bite.
Yeah, maybe. I'm Mr. Marshmallow.
You are Mr. Marshmallow.
It's all talk, innit? All talk, FC.
Yeah.
R.I.P.
Yeah. Right, we're doing five, so we're moving on to another. That's him. Every time he talks shit, he has a coughing fit.
It was the end. Excuse me. This is not good for the pub.
This is not good. This is not good for our brand.
So, yeah, let's do our five-a-side. That is our ranking. Every pod, we rank five of our favourite, five of our best, or... No, just five anything, really, innit? With a couple honourable mentions.
It's our five favourite or our five best of anything. It's a favourite five of something. Like
for sure.
So on the last pod, it was our five most overrated food places.
Yeah.
Or was it fast food? I can't remember.
I think it was just food places, kind of fast-ish food, yeah. Yeah, not like fancy, chains, wasn't it?
Food chains.
Yeah.
Food chains in general. Like Wagamama got a mention.
Yeah. Nando's, I think.
So, go on, tell the people.
So, this one was my suggestion, which was, because it's the start of the NFL season, football season just started, Rugby World Cup started yesterday.
I thought it started like a week ago.
That was like friendlies, you know, warm-up kind of things.
Are England shit all of a sudden?
Yeah, they're dog
shit. We went to the last final together, didn't we? We didn't go to the final, but we went to watch the last final.
Yeah, I was going
to
say, where did
we...
No.
We watched it in the corner.
Yeah. So
we got up at 7 in the morning to watch a rugby
match. It was fucking bare early, isn't it?
Well, and we went to Arsenal that day as well.
It was... Did we?
Yeah, we literally went to watch in the corner, then we went to Arsenal, and then we went out for a beer after.
My memory's getting bad.
It was like... A 12-hour session. We were only about 30 then.
Yeah, only about 30. That was only a few. You're aging us now. Yeah, fuck me.
4 years ago.
The World Cup started now, so it should have been 4 years ago.
Yeah, but there's been a pandemic.
Who knows? I'm still 28. So this week we are doing our favourite athletes of all time. Not the best, although I think I've chalked a few of the best here.
I've definitely chalked
the best. Yeah, have you? All right, so five of our... Favourite athletes of all time. Do you want to go first or should I?
I'll go first.
Yeah. I was trying to get
my
start.
My favourite Arsenal player of all time.
Yeah.
My close friends know this, but a lot of people don't. My favourite Arsenal player of all time is Rositsky. And a lot of people go like, what? Rositsky? But he just brought me so much joy as a player. Like, he looked like he was just loving every minute of playing football. In the Premier League.
Well, when he could, he was fucking injury prone.
He was injured a lot. But he just played the game with a smile on his face, played the game how it's meant to be played, scored some absolutely outrageous goals. He loved to, like, the little turn in the pockets and the balls with the outside of his feet. He was just someone who was just a joy to watch as a player. And so I've had him as my number one. He just, if I could have any Arsenal player back to watch one game live, it would be like a 29, 30-year-old Thomas Rosicky when he was like, when he still had it physically. I mean, if you ever get a chance, watch the first 5-2. The first 5-2 Arsenal-Spurs game in 2012. He scored one and set one up, but he absolutely ran the game. And that was at a time when people were talking about a power shift in North London and Spurs overtaking it. And, you know, Spurs in the midfield at that point, I think, had Scott Parker and Luka Modric. And he just absolutely ran the show. He was at that, and he got Man of the Match as well. That was one of my favourite single performances I've ever seen from Arsenal. So
the thing that people need to understand about Rory, this is for the listeners and not for him, so don't listen to this, Rory.
Okay.
When it comes to football, teams or players, they can't be too bad, but they definitely can't be too good. If they're the best, Rory don't like them. You know, if they're not performing as well as they should, or if they underperform to a degree and they don't fulfil their potential, Rory is all over that shit. Rosicky was a great Arsenal player, didn't play enough, certainly did well in an Arsenal team that probably wasn't the best all the time.
Oh no, he got the back end of a great Arsenal team.
Yeah.
And then most of his career was average.
Yeah, exactly.
By
so
Arsenal standards. He's still won a couple.
I mean, would you consider him an Arsenal legend?
Yes.
You would, of course.
I would consider him an Arsenal legend. I wouldn't consider him the best.
How would the fan base take that? You think the fan base would think he's... Who do you think the fan base would think is more of a player legend? Rosicky or Arteta?
I knew that. So, all I want to say, Rosicky played more games than Arteta. Rosicky scored more goals than Arteta.
Rosicky's more of an Arsenal club man than Arteta. Yeah, I'm just messing you around.
No, I would say most... I mean, not now, actually, because people... I mean, you listen, if you read certain areas of Twitter, you know, Arteta was only behind Zidane in his era of great players, you know what I mean? But I think most people would agree that Rosicky was a better player than Arteta.
So my number one, or it's not in any order, but
Can I just give me a second? I'm just trying to guess in my head who I think your number one's going to be. I'm not going to say it.
All right.
Go on.
Why don't you say it?
I'm not saying it.
The first name on my list is Ian Wright.
Miles off.
Who's he going to pick?
I was going to pick.
No, wait, but I might have him on the list. Is it an Arsenal player? Would you try
no,
to pick
it's not, no, it's not even a footballer.
Would you think he would... This isn't in any order, but would you have thought Ian Wright's like my favourite Arsenal player of all time?
I wouldn't be sure because he's very... Our generation, we're the same age. Like we're like, there's 2 months apart between us.
We're both 28.
Yeah. We got the back. So I think Wright's last good season, we'd have been 10. So it just depends. Because you get some people who grew up with football in their house. Some people get interested in football as teenagers. And then some people get interested in football as adults.
Yeah.
Depending on when you're kind of... Like, love for Arsenal was sparked.
Yeah.
I would say yes. But a lot of people of our age say Henry as well.
Yeah, and they'd probably be right. I think, you know, I was on the back end of Ian Wright.
Yeah.
I remember when he broke the goal scoring record, for sure. Was you?
Yeah, look at that, Arsenal legend. Bolton.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah.
And it's probably definitely nostalgia based, like, because there are a lot of Arsenal players I like. Henri, Fabregas, I thought was fucking excellent.
Fabregas was, one of my best players.
Yeah, I mean, come on. Like, I loved Overmars when he was back in the day. I was always Ljungberg over Pires for some reason.
Really?
Yeah. I don't know why. Pires just ran weird. He didn't look like a footballer to me.
No.
Do you know what I mean?
He was just so French. It was hard to take to him.
Yeah. He looked weird in his uniform. But Ian Wright, you know, maybe with some of the punditry stuff, definitely when he was on I'm a Celebrity, he lost me some money on that because I thought he'd be nice enough to win and he became an arsehole. But as a player and growing up, like, Ian Wright was everything in Islam. He was the man.
Yeah.
You know, and it was like he was scoring every week. There was no reason for him to be that good. He was always slighted by England. He's black.
Yeah.
No, I'm joking.
I know you said that as a joke, but actually Arsenal were the first club in London, a bit before Ian Wright's time, with players like David Rowcastle and Paul Davis, were in the 80s when racism in the UK was like at its absolute peak. And you had like...
You're talking about, it's right now, racism's on the rise.
Yeah, racism, yes.
It's never been as bad as it is right this very second.
Never been as bad.
That abuse that I got in Manchester, I almost cried.
Abuse you get in here, mate.
Oh my, every time I walk in this place.
But in the 80s, when racism in football was like at its peak, Chelsea wouldn't sign a black player.
Yeah.
Charlton had the BNP literally on their terraces, but Arsenal had 3 black players in their team.
Yeah.
So people like Wright and Henry carried that on, but actually, it's the reason Arsenal have so many black fans now, is because people could actually have role models.
Yeah.
And look and go, look, there's three or four black players who play for this team.
Yeah, and he was just a black guy that just... But he wasn't black. Like, do you know what I mean? He was just playing football. He was just who he was.
Everyone.
You know, yeah, Ian Wright, you know, everyone loved him. The smile, the gold tooth. Excellent.
Just a legend.
He is. He's an absolute club legend. Right. Who's your second one?
It's going to be so great. Riquelme. My favourite footballer of all time. Just another one. Probably didn't win.
Give a bit of context to who Riquelme is, because not many people may not know.
So Riquelme has been... He's an Argentinian footballer. He retired in a...
He's like the Argentinian Matt Letizia.
That's actually a great analogy. He spent the majority of his peak playing for Boca Juniors. He did come to Europe and he played for Barcelona for two seasons and he played for Villarreal for three seasons. And he got Villarreal to the Champions League semi-final and is still probably recognised as their best ever player.
If he got to the final and won, you wouldn't like him. Too good.
But he was another one who was just... I mean, if you've got too much time on your hands like I have, go onto YouTube and just type in one Roman Riquelme highlights. And just every game... Every day he would do something ridiculous. He would drop nutmegs, he would just ride challenges, he'd score ridiculous goals, but he was just pure... He was just pure technique. He was slow, he was lanky, he wasn't very strong, but somehow just through outright technique and skill would just run games up to the age of about 36, 37 as well. And I often think if he hadn't been substituted in 2006 in the quarterfinals against Germany for Argentina, Argentina win that World Cup. I also think if he'd have been born 4 years later, or Messi would have been born 4 years earlier, you'd have got them both at their peak at a World Cup, probably in 2010, maybe in 2006. But the problem was, when Riquelme had the team built around him in 2006, Messi was about 17. By the time Messi got to 23, 24, Riquelme was already 34. So they just sort of...
And in Riquelme years, that's like 48.
I mean, he was already really slow to start off with. So him at 34 was like walking pace. But... they just sort of missed each other. Whereas I think if that generation of like sort of Cambiaso, Riquelme, Crespo had have been a little bit older, or they'd have been a little bit younger to be at, sorry, a little bit older to play with like Batistuta and Ortega, or a little bit older to play with Messi, Aguero, Higuain, Di Maria, I think Argentina would have been the dominant team of their era.
Yeah.
And that would have been tough with Spain being as good as they were. But they'd have definitely won more.
I love players just in any sports that are just like... ballers. Do you know what I mean? It's not, they just play the game, you know, and they make it look relatively easy and they succeed, and I just love players like that.
Yeah.
There'll be a few in here which will, in my mind, will be in that same vein.
Again, I think that's going to be a theme with both of us.
Well, it's not the best.
Favourite people are just entertainers. Messi wore number 10. There's been probably two or three better number 10s play for Argentina over the years than Riquelme, but none of them have probably entertained, with the exception of Messi. None of them have probably just entertained as much. I mean, there's one clip of him and he's in a blind alley down by the corner flag and he just backheels it through his opponent's legs and then runs around and collects the ball. Like, just doing ridiculous stuff like that on a football pitch. So, yeah, that's my number two.
My number two, big NBA fan me.
This is the one.
Yeah, who is it?
Carmelo.
Fuck off.
Really?
Melo?
Yeah.
No, not even close. I don't even like Melo.
Did you not used to like Melo?
No.
Why did I have it in my head that you used to really like Carmelo?
No, I mean, I liked him when he was at Denver for a bit, but...
That's what I was going
to
say.
But I wouldn't put him anywhere close to even... Gosh, top 10, top 15. There are many, many players that I love. My favourite player of all time, I decided last year, is Stephen Curry. I mean, the guy, you talk about a guy that entertains. The guy's a freak of nature in terms of, he's supposed to be a small guy, he's a point guard. He shoots better than anyone that's ever existed. And that's not even, you know, sometimes you can debate certain things in sports and who's better, Ronaldo, Messi, who's better. I don't know if Pele and Maradona, there was always comparisons. With basketball, the argument is always between now LeBron James and Michael Jordan. But when it comes to certain things that you cannot debate, Steph Curry is the greatest shooter the world has ever seen. And it's not even close. That's how devastating is he chucks that thing up like he's a 5-year-old. He just fucking throws it up, thing goes in.
As someone who is very much a casual basketball, I'm nowhere near as into basketball as you are. When I was at uni, I used to watch it at night when I had a mucked up sleeping pattern. I got quite into it for about 18 months. But you are an NBA guy. Like, at one point, it was your favourite sport. I don't know if it is your favourite sport.
But, not now, yeah.
But, yeah, Curry, I got the beginning of Steph Curry. So I think when I started watching the NFL, probably, sorry, the NBA, 2013, 2014, LeBron was the guy, but he was still at the Heat.
Yeah.
And Curry was probably in his second or third year.
Yeah.
And he was ridiculous then. But then when I stopped watching, by all accounts, he's gone to a stupid...
But like, how many players, you said like Raquelme or something, where when you're watching them play, you just start laughing out loud. Like,
oh yeah,
I'm in hysterics watching him do what
shots,
he does.
Some of the shots...
My goodness.
Yeah. Also, people don't realise how heavy that basketball is.
Oh yeah, yeah.
And he just lobs it around.
Flick of the wrist, just flip. And but it's... It's absurd what he does. The thing where he did with Chris Paul, where he was against the Clippers, actually, where he dribbled between three players. He was facing his own basket. He just kind of picked up, turned around, chucked it in. It should have been a dead play. Like, he's boxed in, like, three defenders around him, and he just chucks it up, swish. Not even, like, backboard in, no digga-digga-digga-digga,
no,
like,
it
is clip in there.
I read somewhere that they had to change the algorithms on the NBA PS5 game, because... Basically, if they'd have made Steph Curry's shooting as good as it was in real life, it would have all you'd have had to do is just give the ball.
You
to
could
Curry
shoot from anywhere on the floor.
On the court,
as soon as he gets past half court, shoot, and it's going to go in at least half the time.
Yeah.
And that is massive.
Yeah.
Plus, he's for me, he's the most talented basketball player I think that's ever existed, at least that I've seen. The most talented. He can dribble as good as anyone that has ever been. He shoots better than anyone that's ever been. His layups and his is as good as anyone when he drives to the basket. He can pass as good as anyone. He's just 6'3". Like, his endurance is crazy. The guy does not stop running. There isn't a fitter player out there. He's just got everything. If he was LeBron James size, if he was 6'5", they would call him the best player of all time because of the attributes
that
he has.
There's people that say he's the best player of all time.
And they rightfully should, because there is many arguments for that. He's got 4 championships. He gets taken away with the amount of finals MVPs that he hasn't won versus league MVPs, because I think he's got 2 league MVPs or 3. He definitely got 2 back to back. He's the first ever unanimous MVP vote in NBA history, which is, you know, they say that it's a bit of a weird one, that calling that, but it's still a claim he can make.
Oh, I mean, imagine someone getting 95% of the Ballon d'Or vote in football. Like,
yeah.
That'd be insane. And
yeah.
That's pretty, essentially what Curry did.
Yeah, exactly. Like, because usually they're done by like. Journalists in for the MVP vote, so there'd always be like a homer being like, Michael Jordan is unanimously the greatest player of all time. He won 6 MVPs or something. There was always going to be one or two guys saying, "Nah, this guy's better." Stephen Curry's likability factor was so high that everyone liked him, which is so rare. Like, these are journalists from other sports fan base. These are like homers who voted for him. So he's just a guy. I love him to bits, and he plays with a smile on his face.
He does play with a smile on his face. Right, my next one. Doesn't really need to go into too much detail, but Zinedine Zidane is, I think, the best midfielder I've ever seen. Like, and it's not... I mean, I love Iniesta as well, but Zidane...
You can make an argument that he is the best player.
You can make an argument. I don't really say it anymore because people kick off. I still have him above Ronaldo.
And you can, yeah.
I don't think I've ever seen anybody with... Just be that big and just have that... Just get the ball. Him with a football is like me. Well, he has more control over a football than I do walking my dog.
Yeah.
Like, he has such a command over the football. It's just insane. And add to the fact that he's 6'3" and he glides like Thierry Henry. He can play as a holding midfielder. He can play as a number 10. He can play as a box-to-box centre midfielder. He scored outrageous goals. He was a great tackler. People like question most people's game. People question some area of it. Zidane, you can't. Is he good with his head? Well, he scored 2 goals in a World Cup final with his head. Is he good with his left foot? Well, he scored the greatest goal in Champions League final history until Bale's with his left foot. Like, he's...
The only thing that people would say, I would imagine, against Zidane is that he's not Messi or Ronaldo. You're not these players.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, you can argue about longevity, the amount of goals that you score, accolades. You know, sometimes you just got to look at players for what they are. You look at them, it's the eye test. And when you look at someone like Zidane, it's just like, it is beauty, it's art, it's exactly what you want football to be.
Mm-hmm.
The guy makes it look easier than anything else.
Because
if you you know, if I don't know, if you had Ronaldo, Messi, Zidane, Maradona, Pele, maybe a couple of others, like, who's going to be the standout one? Zidane could very much be the standout one. They all got their chances of standing out. But it's not like Zidane's going to be, oh, he's easily worse than the others.
Yeah, and he's one of them players that almost everyone that plays against him says, yeah, he's the best player I've ever seen.
Yeah,
and, like, even like people would always say he only won one Ballon d'Or, but he had two taken off him. He had one in 98 taken off him, or was 98 the one he won? I think he won it in 2002 as well. One of them he had taken off him because he stamped on someone.
Mm.
And got
he was a nutcase.
Yeah, and then in 2006 he would have won it as well, but he headbutted Materazzi in the World Cup final. So he didn't get it for that. So he could well, in an era that also included Ronaldinho, Batistuta, R9, Luis Figo, he could still have ended up with three Ballon d'Or.
Well, he arguably probably played in the greatest footballing generations,
yeah,
right?
For me, yeah.
Like, the amount of players that have come out of, what, the late 90s, early 2000s that could be one of the best players of all time. And it was so dense with how many good forwards there was, midfielders non-stop.
Defenders.
Everyone was, yeah, like, yeah, football at its prime, like the golden age. Like, yeah. You know, no, we had the golden...
Because of our age, though.
Probably.
In 15 years' time, are there going to be kids now going, honestly, they don't make strikers like Haaland anymore?
Well, it's...
Like,
yeah.
Like, do you know what I mean? Because we always look back at, like, our era. And I will swear...
Yeah, you'll never get another Sterling again.
Yeah, never have another manager like Southgate.
Yeah, yeah. Because the argument that any young person could say about athletes today is that technically they're better athletes.
They are, 100%. Yeah, of course they are.
They are technically better players, but the argument is your impact on stuff. Like, with the people within your generation, how do you compete against them lot? And that's the only really thing I think you can... It's why you can never say... We could never really argue that Pele or Maradona is the best footballer of all time, because we never lived through it. We could have an argument with people at the late 90s. Yeah. That's when you start going to stats and stuff. But yeah, Zidane's
but
just...
But you could also argue that if, like, Luis Figo, who was never known for being that fast, if he'd have grown up with the protection that wide players get now, and also, like, being able to go into a cryogenic chamber after every game and recover twice as quick, and, you know, like, how much better would he be? Because he would go and play a Champions League game for Real Madrid or Barcelona, and then the Saturday after, have to play, like, Real Sociedad, where he's got some Italian right back trying to actually fucking kill him.
Like, yeah, and when you get these players that are playing, like, into their prime when they're like 37, 38, it seems, you know, it's like you they play for 25 years, your all stats are going to get broken.
Yeah, exactly.
My next one, I'm a big MMA guy, and this is the person that got me into cage fighting. Yeah, is a guy called Rich Franklin, right? There was a number of different people that I could have put in there, but for me, Rich Franklin was the guy that got me into it because he looked like Ace Ventura, and he was an excellent fighter. He was the middleweight champion of UFC. Anderson Silva, who is debatably the best, and I almost put Anderson Silva there in that list, but Rich Franklin just gets it because I just loved it. Like, he was the first person that came in that was a proper athlete. He was also a good striker. He basically could do everything. MMA has turned into, you have to be able to do everything to compete at the best levels for the most, the highest level for the most part. He was the first person to really try and tie it together as much as possible. And I just loved watching it. I just loved it. When Anderson Silva beat him, that was hard to watch. And yeah, loved the guy.
Is he done
now? Ah, he's been retired for years. Yeah. Oh, yeah, it's like early 2000s, maybe 2004, 5, 6. So quite a while ago. I mean, I've been watching MMA now for like 20 years, it seems. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a long time to be watching. Yeah. MMA. So I'm going to switch. This one might surprise you a little bit because I don't watch this sport.
Is it a sumo wrestler?
No. It's a tennis player.
Oh.
Federer.
Of course, I've got him on my list.
Like, oh, really? Yeah. I've gone through different stages in my life of liking different sports. Like, between sort of 2008 and 2012, I was banging to tennis.
Yeah.
Like, more so than I was into cricket or football. And then sort of basketball sort of took over because I was up late at night and could watch that. But, yeah, Federer, there was a point where I'd get as upset watching Federer lose, which didn't happen very often, but he would often lose in finals and stuff. And I'd get as upset watching him lose as any other sporting thing. Like, I genuinely was rooting for him so much. Like,
yeah.
He'd just come across like just the ultimate professional, just the ultimate nice guy, and would just play shots that you just go, fucking hell. It's the similar thing. Like, people love Djokovic and Nadal, and I completely see why people love Djokovic and Nadal. But in terms of actual wow shots, Federer, no one comes close.
Well, I think the thing with Federer is that he was also the best at or up there with all of the different attributes that you want. He was one of the best servers. May not be the fastest, but he was getting more as many aces as anyone out there. His winners, like he would ridiculous. He just non-stop. The thing with Federer for me is that he is the ultimate making it look easy. The guy didn't sweat.
Yeah.
guy did not sweat. Never looked like he was straining. His backhand was just whoosh, like just opened that up. Just absolutely whipped it, no stress. I remember when I was on holiday, because I used to love Andy Roddick. And when Federer was first coming through, when Federer was really coming through, before it became like Nadal and then Djokovic and Andy Murray, before there was like them big four.
It was Safin and Roddick.
Yeah, and yeah, exactly.
And Leighton Hewitt as well,
yeah, and they weren't on Federer's level. And Federer would always beat him in the finals. I was on holiday once, and I just remember saying, like, Federer, man, he's just like a swan.
Yeah. I know exactly what you mean. Cause
he just glides across the court, just flapping his wing, just batting it away.
Also, he'd win majors. It'd be like the final of Wimbledon or the final of the Australian Open. He'd need one game to win, and it'd be his serve. And you think, like, normal players muddle their way through their winning game, whereas he'd just go ace, serve and volley, ace.
Yeah.
And I remember he beat Murray in the Wimbledon final. Literally by just going ace, serve and volley winner, ace.
Yeah.
And it was just like, how can you make it look so easy?
That's right. I think with Federer, like, generally, I will always argue who I think is the best of different sports, but I'll feel like as time goes by, I would be open-minded for other people to have other points of views. When it comes to Federer, I really don't think I'll ever change my mind by the fact that I think we witnessed the greatest tennis player of all time.
Yeah.
I just could never imagine anyone being better. They'll say Djokovic, maybe because he might get more...
he's got more majors now.
Yeah.
Djokovic, I think the problem with Djokovic is he's quite robotic.
He's not got a competition either.
Yeah, that's true. He's always been 5 years younger than Federer.
Exactly.
So he's always.
And then he only came into his prime when Federer and Nadal got too old.
That's a fair point. I mean, I think Nadal might have only been around the age of 30. If you say that Djokovic came into his prime around sort of 2012-2013, Federer was already 33-34 then.
Yeah.
Nadal might have been 29-30.
Yeah.
But I do know what you mean.
But not only was Federer like statistically the best, right? Not only was he doing the best things out on the court, he made it look the best. He made it look easy.
Yeah.
He was lovable. It was holistically. He had everything. There was nothing you could take away from him. Yeah. Everyone knew he was the guy. Everyone liked him. No one was like, oh, I don't really like that guy. Some people say they don't like Nadal for certain reasons. People don't like Djokovic because of the way his attitude is. Andy Murray. How many times do people say, I don't like Federer?
No, very rare. And the thing is with Nadal, there's like people don't like how slow he is, whereas that never bothered me.
Because you're slow.
People with Djokovic just don't like his attitude.
Yeah, but he's a bit of a cunt.
Because he's Scottish. Like, you know. Anyway, what's your next one?
I might as well do my last one, because Roger Federer is on my list. My last one is my favourite rugby player of all time, Brian O'Driscoll.
Oh, people love O'Driscoll. Bod. Oh, man, I love O'Driscoll.
Bod. He was just, again, like, you know, he was in an Ireland team that was always up there competing for Six Nations. He won a couple Grand Slams, never quite did it in the World Cup final.
Did they get to a World Cup final?
I don't think they did. I think they might have made it to a semi one time.
They might win this year, I'm hearing.
Them or France, really. Not that I've watched it that much. But Brian O'Driscoll was just excellent. He played the game incredibly fun. He was creative. He was quick. Great tackler. Like, you couldn't get by him. And I think he was only like 5'10". And 5'10" for his position in rugby.
Was he a scrum half?
No, he was a outside centre. Which, you know, usually the...
Number 8 or something.
No, that's 13. So, yeah, you ain't got a fucking clue. Just shut up. Just stop talking. Huh?
No. When it comes to rugby, not a single clue. But
not
do,
a Scooby-Doo.
I do know about O'Driscoll, though.
Yeah.
The Irish family.
He was just... he definitely made me proud to be Irish, that's for sure.
I always forget you're Irish.
Yeah, quarter Irish.
Quarter Irish,
yeah. He was the man. He was so good. There's this one way we... he's got these shit gloves on, which is horrible. But basically, he's running along. He throws it over his player's head. Because you can pass it to yourself if you pass it backwards.
Yeah.
He uses him as a dummy, but he throws it over the guy's head, catches it, and then runs and then passes the ball, and then the guy gets a try. It's just outrageous. Yeah, people don't do that sort of shit.
No. It's like, again, entertainer.
Yeah, yeah. and excellent though, like technically just great. You know, he weren't just all a showman. He could actually play the game, and you know, if anyone that can tackle in rugby is a serious player for sure. I could never tackle.
Last one, I've gone for an NFL player because it's probably my favorite.
Tom Brady?
Not Brady. And also,
oh, let me get this.
I don't think you'll get it. It's someone I love, but it's not a Vikings player.
Ooh, okay.
Who's no longer playing?
All right. No, I'm not going to get it then.
Larry Fitzgerald.
Really?
Yeah. Because of all the great players people talk about, all of, you know, if you're talking about before our time of watching American football.
Yeah.
Of all of the great players, so Peyton Manning, Randy Moss, Calvin Johnson, even Adrian Peterson, Brady. I only very much got them when they were, like in Brady's case, he was in his 40s.
Yeah.
With all the rest of them, they were finished. Whereas I got to watch the last 3 or 4 years of Larry Fitzgerald every week and see, for me, him and Brady are the only two all-time greats at their position that I can say I watched him. Do you see what I'm saying? Like,
yeah.
I can say I watched him and I experienced
him. I never really watched Cardinals games, so that's probably why.
I used to watch Cardinals games purely because the Vikings were always on at 6 in the evening, UK time. And then the 9:25 game, I'd have a choice. And it would usually be the Chargers against someone, the Rams against someone, or the Cardinals. It'd be someone in the West.
Yeah.
So I'd always pick the Cardinals. Just because the year before they'd been on All or Nothing as well.
Yeah.
Which so I sort of like, and Bruce Arians was the coach, and they still had Patrick Peterson, and
they were a good side.
Carson Palmer as their quarterback. They actually still had a really, they're not the Cardinals now, who are fucking dreadful and have been for about 3 seasons. I always sort of had a soft spot for the Cardinals, and watching Larry Fitz, like, I would have loved him to have won the Super Bowl before he retired, because he seems like such an amazing guy. Just,
yeah, everyone. I mean, people that talk about Larry Fitzgerald, like, he's just so highly regarded. The funny thing with the NFL, like, with the best players that are there, because it's so hard to win, and it's so hard to get any kind of accolades, that it's hard to, especially with certain positions, they'll talk about this player is the best player, this player is the best player. But he's not really got much to show for it, outside of just catches and yards, really.
Yeah, no, but I mean, he'll be a Hall of Famer.
For sure.
But to retire, having played for like quite an average Cardinals team, I think he got to one Super Bowl in his career. And he got to the NFC Championship in 2015. And
yeah.
Cam Newton's Panthers beat him. But to finish second all-time in catches, second all-time in receiving yards, it's just incredible. And to play at that level, I was looking at his stats earlier. He had 9 seasons of 1,000 yards or above. 9.
Yeah, yeah.
Like,
with not even like the best quarterback.
Never really having a good quarterback. I think he might have got the back end of the,
what, Kurt Warner.
The back end of
that Kurt was when Warner, they made it to the Super
when
Super
they
Bowl.
Made it to the Super Bowl. He got the back.
Why do I know that more than football? It's ridiculous. Yeah.
I just think you just remember Super Bowls because they're events, maybe. But he got the back end of Kurt Warner, who is probably well into his late 30s by then.
Yeah.
And then he got 2 or 3 years of good Carson Palmer. And other than that, maybe
not really much. Dross.
Yeah, and just a really
Was he around with Kyler Murray?
He might have had Kyler Murray's first
for one
season,
yeah.
But I mean, his last season, I think he got like 400 yards or something.
Yeah.
But I watched the football life of him as well, and he's just such a great guy. He comes across as just such, he's been to, he likes, like, his hobby is travelling. He's been to something like 100.
Like you like travelling.
I like travelling.
Yeah, yeah. Just tell the fans.
Don't have
Do you know, one pod we'll do about your travelling escapades. So why don't we do that, yeah?
Well, do you know what? Larry Fitzgerald, if I had his money, I'd do just as much travelling as Larry Fitzgerald.
Yeah, but you go to Magaluf, you go to Ibiza,
Portugal,
Benidorm, yeah, all the hotspots.
All the cultural hotspots.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, he's been to like 125 countries or something insane. So Larry Fitzgerald makes it onto my list.
Yeah.
And I was going to, should I just whiz through my honourable mentions?
Yeah, we can both do that.
Right, my honourable mentions: Adrian Peterson, although, yep, I only saw him for a season, so he couldn't go in my 5. I've spent more time watching highlights of Adrian Peterson, because I only saw him for a season at my team, at the Vikings. After he left the Vikings, he had a good season at Washington and another season at the Cardinals, which is why I watched
Yeah, was he at Washington? I was like,
Washington for a season, Cardinals for a season, and then he bounced around about another 3 teams. So Adrian Peterson I've put on there, but I didn't watch him enough I didn't watch good Adrian Peterson enough. My other two, because the other two sports I watched hadn't been represented. So I had Brian Lara, one of the best batsmen of all time. I got to watch him live when I was about 16 at Lord's, and he was over the hill, but still the highlight of my day. Did everything in slow motion. Like, it was just another one. You watch him play, he just made it look so fucking easy, even when he was in his late 30s. And my last one was Kevin Durant, because he was the first ever basketball player I watched. Well, you were talking about shooting earlier with Curry. I was. It was a Christmas Eve, and I just flipped it on because I was waiting for the Ashes in about 2013, and the Thunder were playing the Lakers, I think, on Christmas Day, actually. Either Christmas Eve or Christmas Day, 10 o'clock at night. And I'm watching it for about 5 minutes. And I call my brother. I'm like, mate, you need to come and see this geezer. I'm like, there is this geezer in the... I didn't even know that. I was like, playing for the white team. And honestly, he scores every time he gets the ball. Now, I'm no expert, but I don't think you're meant to score every time you get the ball. And he was just taking up that position on the right that he does. And Westbrook was playing as well. Westbrook was just throwing the ball out to him, and he was just literally going donk, like, made it look so easy. I don't know how you feel about Durant, but
Durant is one of the most talented basketball players of all time. All time great, unbelievable scorer. He's like a 6'11", 7 foot guy who's just as lanky as shit, but is just an absolute animal when it comes to basketball and scoring in particular.
Twitter's funny as
well. Yeah, well, I think the thing about him is that a lot of people would say that he hasn't reached the heights that he probably should have in terms of, like, MVPs. He had a couple championship years when it was with Golden State, but that's because he came to my guys, Steph Curry's team, and they're saying, well, he didn't do it himself. Since then, he's tried to bounce around to Brooklyn. He's at Phoenix now and really hasn't put it together. But the thing about him is that I think he's just someone that... He does want to win, but he's just someone that just loves basketball and wants to play. Maybe he should be a bit more thoughtful around what he's doing if he wants to actually succeed, but the guy just loves playing basketball. I love Durant. I think he's excellent. I think that people put him down a bit too much for his lack of, I don't know, what being the main guy in a championship team, but it's so hard. I don't know. I think he's hot shit. I used to have a Durant jersey. You're thinking about, like, Melo, I'm more of a Durant guy than I am.
Oh, really?
Yeah, a million times over. I've got one from Supersonic.
A Supersonic? Worth so much.
It's one season. Yeah, I've got that at home.
That's worth dough.
Yeah, is it?
Yeah. I love a vintage jersey.
My honourable mentions, we'll get through this. Muhammad Ali, just because I know we're talking about ones that we watch, but, like, when it comes to boxing, in my household, like, he was always a name that was quite prevalent. Just probably loved the idea of him more than actually his boxing, because we didn't watch it. But then when you watch him box, even just with videos, you kind of see, well, he could probably do a job in this day and age if he was more of an athlete, because he was a bit doughy. But other than that, like...
It's funny how back in the day, in the 60s, he was known as, like, the ultimate physical specimen.
Yeah,
whereas you look at him now, and he was a bit...
Yeah, he's got, like, no abs.
Yeah.
Yeah, doughy as fuck.
You look at him now compared to... But then saying that Tyson Fury, you look at him, and he's not exactly...
Yeah, exactly.
The pinnacle of humanity, is he?
No. He's definitely not the pinnacle of humanity. Fucking Gypsy King. Dirk Nowitzki is a basketball player, German guy. It's so close to putting him as my favourite of all time. I love Dirk Nowitzki. He played for Dallas Mavericks.
He won a championship.
Him winning a championship against the Heat, which was their first year when LeBron James went there, is one of my favourite sport. I watched every game, and it's just one of my favourites.
Because that's why you could, that's the same with me. I got into it when I was at uni, because you could stay.
You got
up
all that
watching.
Fucking free time, innit?
Yeah.
It was just an amazing... I'm so happy he won it. Like, so, so happy. Steve Nash, the same. He was one of my favourite basketball players.
Did he play for the Phoenix Suns, Steve Nash?
He played... That's where he won his two MVPs. He came close to having the best team he could have had. Lost against Kobe Bryant and the Lakers, I think, in the Western Conference Finals. But he was... I don't know. I just loved him. He was an amazing passer. Like, he was always the type of player that I would love to think I would be before Steph Curry came. Because he was basically Steph Curry in a way before Steph Curry was there. He was a good three-point shooter, good part. He was a much better passer, much more of a playmaker. But in terms of the actual attributes, I love three-point shooters. So he was up there for me. Johnny Wilkinson, I mean...
Legend.
There's just not much to say. The thing about Johnny Wilkinson, there used to be that advert with him and David Beckham. David Beckham had all that love. He was never the best player, right? Was he ever the best player in his team, really?
No.
Any teams that he was in?
I mean, when he went to the MLS, he was probably best.
Oh, yeah, yeah, take that.
He was never the best at Real Madrid, but he was never the best at United.
But Johnny Wilkinson, not only was a national treasure, not only was he the poster boy of England rugby, he was one of the most famous athletes in our country. He was England's best player.
Who in Mustard.
He was.
But he also didn't. Also, and I'm no rugby fan. I have to caveat this, but in the one moment when his country needed him in the World Cup final, with minutes on the clock, he picked up the ball and scored. I was about to score a field goal. It's not called a conversion.
A drop goal.
He picked up the ball and scored a drop goal,
which is arguably the hardest thing to do.
Because you're on the move.
I mean, it's ridiculous. Yeah. With his opposite foot, by the way.
Really?
He's left footed. He did it with his right foot.
Yeah, that's insane.
What are you doing? Yeah. What are you doing,
that,
sir?
2003, that was.
Yeah,
that was my first times in a pub.
I never used to be into rugby then, and I remember turning the TV on in the morning and watching.
Early, it was like 7.
Yeah, and I was just in my bedroom, and I, 2003, not even really understanding what I was watching. And I remember watching it, and then years back, realising, fuck, what I just watched that. I wish I appreciated more at the time. And then the last rugby player for me is Dan Carter.
He was New Zealand
fly half. A lot of people say Richie McCaw's the greatest All Black of all time. For me, I just don't know how you can get much better than Dan Carter as a player. He, for me, would be like the Federer of rugby. Just ease. Didn't sweat. Glided. Could pass. Could kick. Could run. Wasn't the most devastating of tackle like Johnny Wilkinson. But, you know, he could do a job. He was just so silky.
It makes you wonder how with a population of about 17 million or whatever. Probably even less. Maybe 5 million. They produce so many ridiculous rugby players.
I think it's the same thing as Brazil. They've always got... When you talk to New Zealanders and why they all play rugby, they've always got a rugby ball in their hand. They walk around with it. Like, you get the feel of the ball. Like, you know, playing around... You know, if you're just walking with a ball on the street and just... That's how they live. Everything is to produce just good rugby players. Yeah. And it's from day one. And they all play with the ball in their hand. So it's always going to be the best of the best.
And apparently rugby's on the TV there non-stop as well.
It's their national sport.
Like the same way we have football on the TV non-stop.
Yeah.
And in America they have the NBA and the NFL on the TV.
Yeah.
They're the same with rugby.
Yeah, exactly.
Crazy stuff.
There you go. Alright.
Should we get out of this sauna?
Fuck me, it's hot in here, yeah.
You got a little bead of sweat.
Have I? Yeah. Shit, man.
I think I probably have as well.
A little bead of sweat, more coming. It's gotten really hot all of a sudden, isn't it?
Yeah.
Right, good stuff. We will see you soon. I can't remember if I say something at the end.